was hard work. Orphanelle was strapped onto a decline bench, a soaked towel suctioned onto his face. Van Sciver had been pouring a steady stream of fresh spring water through the towel and into Elle's sinuses, larynx, oropharynx, trachea, and bronchi. It didn't actually reach the lungs. It just felt like it. Van Sciver had been waterboarded as part of his training. All orphans were. The discomfort almost defied explanation. He'd been drown-proofed as well, and by comparison, that was a breeze. Bound at the bottom of a swimming pool, breathing in water, the head going hazy as in a dream. But this felt like having a water hose opened up inside your skull. The more you gasped for air, the further you pulled the towel into your mouth, an octopus clutching your face, expelling an endless stream of fluid through your orifices. Van Sciver nodded at Thornhill, who lifted the soaked towel from Orphanelle's face. For a time, Draker bobbed on the bench, bloodshot eyes bulging, mouth guppying. He didn't make a noise. When the upper respiratory tract filled, water obstruction prevented the diaphragm from expanding and contracting to produce a suitable cough. You had to fight to earn your oxygen. 5 seconds passed as Draker contorted, clutching for air. Thornhill gazed down at him with empathetic eyes. I feel you, pal. I feel you. Candy leaned against the mattress cushioning the far wall, examining her fingernails. They looked freshly painted. Aubergine. Van Sciver looked back at Thornhill, nodded again. Thornhill undid the straps around Elle's chest and thighs, and Elle rolled off the bench onto his side. When he struck the floor, the impact loosed his lungs, his head seeming to explode with jets of water. He coughed, heaved, coughed some more. Thornhill slapped his back a few times, encouragingly. There you go. Draker whipped up in a violent sit-up, driving his forehead at Thornhill's nose. Thornhill wheeled back, nearly losing his footing. He looked down at his shirt, darkened by the spray from Draker's wet hair. Draker's headbutt had missed him by inches. "Whoa, cowboy," Thornhill said, seemingly pleased by the effort. "That was close." Draker collapsed flat on the floor, spent. Van Sciver squatted beside him, knees cracking, alert. "The boy," he said. "The address." Draker gagged a few times. Van Sciver pressed two fingers into his solar plexus, and Draker vomited a water-clear stream so calmly and steadily that it was like opening up a tap. When he was done, he took a few seconds to catch his breath. Then he said, "What boy?" "Right on," Candy said. "Gotta admire the grit." She peeled herself from the wall and tested the plywood covering one of the rear windows. It was screwed in tight, but not too tight, which was perfect. Van Sciver said to Thornhill, "Get the dog collar on him." The next technique, walling, was a Guantanamo Bay special. There they slipped a rolled towel around the detainee's neck and used it to slam him into a semi-flexible wall. The shoulder blades hit first, snapping the head. The collision gives off a sound like a thunderclap, like someone banging cymbals in the space between your ears. Van Sciver preferred to use an actual collar. They were more durable, and his meaty hand never slipped. Plus, when he squeezed tight, he'd found, his knuckles shoved into the larynx, which added a bit more incentive. Thornhill secured the collar around Elle's neck. "I don't know about this, bud," Thornhill said, flashing that carefree smile. "I was you. I'd just talk to the man." Elle lay there, curled on his side, panting. Van Sciver knew how it was. You had to enjoy the respites when you had them. It was tough work from both sides. "Get him on his feet," Van Sciver said. Draker was limp, his muscles turned to rubber. Candy and Thornhill juggled him up, holding most of his weight. He'd gone boneless. Van Sciver seized the collar and dragged Elle over to the plywood sheet. "Where is David Smith?" he asked again. Draker couldn't speak, not with the knuckles, but he managed to shake his head. "Damn," Van Sciver said, setting his feet and firming his grip. "You must really love the kid." 46. Menu of Even More Specialized Services. At the edge of an industrial park in Northridge, through two security doors, past a warehouse humming with painters and restorers reviving valuable vintage movie posters, down a back hall tinged with the smell of petroleum and cleaning surfactants, Melinda Trung stood in a dark-walled photography room, fists on her slender hips, regarding Evan and Joey. Melinda wore yoga pants and spotless robin's egg blue Pumas that looked to be limited edition and pricier than most vehicles. Straight black hair fell to her waist, which was gripped by a construction worker's tool belt that required freshly awled holes so it could be cinched tighter in order to accommodate her tiny frame. The tool belt held an Olympus double-action airbrush, a 000 paintbrush, and various sizes of X-Acto blades, their grips padded with pink tape to discourage her workers from borrowing them. She was the sole woman in the building. She was the owner of the operation. She was also the finest forger Evan had ever encountered. One of her fists still gripped a retrofitted insecticide atomizer. Evan had interrupted her at the wet table over a Frankenstein one-sheet from 1931, cleaning a coffee spot off Boris Karloff's cheek. The restored movie poster would be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that was far less than she made from her menu of even more specialized services, conducted here in the photography room with its windows blacked out, ostensibly to prevent reflections during shooting. She ticked the muzzle of the atomizer at Evan now, a show of mock annoyance. "It's a good thing I have a secret crush on you," she said, "or I'd never let you stomp in here with this child and interrupt my work." "I'm not a child," Joey said. Melinda did not look over at her, instead holding up a finger. "Seen, but not heard." Joey zippered her mouth. Evan said, "Apologies." Melinda swept back her hair, a gesture that was at once concise and sensuous, and tapped her cheek. Evan complied, moving forward to kiss it. At the last minute, she turned, catching his lips with hers. She lingered a moment, then shoved him back. "Now, what do you want?" Joey took this in speechlessly. "I need full papers for her," Evan said. "Multiple IDs, social, driver's, birth certificate, travel visas. A backstopped history. Make her 18. "When?" Melinda asked. "Now." Melinda looked over at her cobbler's bench covered with etched metal plates, embossing tools, letterpress drawers holding passport stamps. She sighed. Then she snapped her fingers at Joey, who stepped forward as if jabbed with a cattle prod. Melinda took her chin in hand and turned her face this way and that, assessing the face behind which she was going to build a new identity. Beneath all that scowling and the weird haircut, "You are a very pretty girl," she finally conceded. "Thank you." "It's not a compliment. It's an observation." The sounds of the workers in the warehouse carried up the hall. Suction tables roaring, equipment racks wheeling from station to station, exclamations rising above the din. Melinda released Joey's face, picked up a phone on the desk next to an AMSCOPE binocular microscope, and punched a button. Then she said in her native tongue, "Be quiet. I can't hear myself think in here, and when I can't think, I act on emotion." The entire building silenced immediately. She hung up the phone. When she turned back, Joey's mouth was slightly ajar. Joey said, "You were one badass lady." "Yes, honey," Melinda said. "I am sure." 47. The Language of Comfort. Before bed, Evan showered, dressed, and then finished tidying up the vault as best he could. He found himself trying to align the monitors on the floor and finally gave up. Chaos was a small price to pay when a 13-year-old boy's life was at stake. He stared at the various progress bars, all that software dredging the web for signs of David Smith. "Work faster," he said. As he turned to leave, a rapid-fire series of beeps chimed from the alarm system, indicating an intruder at the windows or balconies. His eyes darted around the vault, searching the rejiggered monitors to find the one holding the appropriate security feed. He was two steps to the gun locker when he found it, and relaxed. On the screen, he watched a dark shape hover outside his bedroom window, bumping the glass. He sighed and stepped through the shower and the bathroom. As he emerged into his bedroom, Joey entered from the hall. She was wearing pajama bottoms and a loose-fitting T-shirt. She said, "What's that noise?" Evan pointed to the window. An old-fashioned diamond kite flapped in the breeze, smacking against the pane. Peter's bedroom was directly below Evan's, 9 floors down. "A kid's kite?" Joey said. Evan opened the window and pulled in the yellow kite. Scotch-taped to the underside was a small freezer bag containing a folded piece of loose-leaf paper and a pencil. He removed the note. Written in blue crayon, "Your niece person is cool. Does she like me, too? Check yes or no. Your friend, Peter." There were two boxes. He handed the note to Joey. She took it, her eyebrows lifted with surprise. As she read, a micro-expression flickered across her face, gone as soon as it appeared. But he'd noticed. She was charmed. When she looked up at Evan, she'd fixed her usual look of annoyance on her face. "Nice spelling," she said. He handed her the pencil. She sighed. "Seriously?" "Seriously." She held the paper, tapped the pencil against her full bottom lip, as if contemplating. Then she checked a box, not letting Evan see. She stuffed the note back into the little bag and tossed the kite out the window. It nosedived from view. He knew which box she'd checked. She said, "You going to bed?" "After I meditate." "Meditate?" "Jack never taught you?"
"No. We didn't have time for that."
She wet her lips, seemingly uncomfortable.
"Why do you do it?" "Meditate."
He contemplated. Jack had taught him this along with so much else. How to find peace. How to embody stillness. How to punch and scream a dagger between the fourth and fifth ribs, angling up at the heart. It struck Evan anew how Jack had embodied so many contradictions. Gruff, but gentle. Insistent, but patient. Firm, but hands-off. He'd known how to raise Evan. How to push him further than he wanted to go. Joey was watching him expectantly, slightly nervous, a flush rouging her smooth cheeks. Her question touched on the intimate, and that put her over her skis. He remembered telling her that Jack was the first person who ever really saw him. "If no one sees you, how can you know you're real?" Evan tried to imagine how Jack might see Joey.
"Your Rubik's Cube," he said,
"from the motel. The shapeshifter with all the different planes?" She nodded. "You told me that to bring it into alignment, you solve one dimension at a time. Shape first, then color. You said you look for the wayward pieces, find the right patterns to make them fall into place. Right?"
"Right."
"That's what meditating is. Finding the wayward pieces of yourself. Bringing them into alignment."
"But how?"
He went to the bed, sat cross-legged, pointed to a spot opposite him. She climbed on the bed and mirrored his pose. Hands on thighs, straight spine, shoulders relaxed.
"What now?"
she asked. "Nothing."
"So I just breathe?"
"Yes."
"Just sit here and breathe?"
if you want to. Her eyes shone. Focus on your breath, he said, and nothing else. See where it leads you. He let his vision loosen until Joey blurred into the wall behind her. He tracked the cool air through his nose, down his windpipe, into his stomach. Beneath his skin he sensed a turmoil, blood rushing through his veins. His thoughts cascaded, cards in a shuffled deck. Jack in freefall, a cup of half-drunk milk, the frayed shoulder of David Smith's shirt. Joey's words slashed in at him. This is fucking stupid. He opened his eyes fully. She'd come out of the pose, slumping forward, at once lax and agitated. He watched her twist one hand in the other. Okay, he said. We done? Sure. She didn't move. She was glaring at him. It didn't do anything. Sure it did, Evan said. It led you to anger. That's real useful. What am I supposed to do with that? Ask yourself, what are you angry about? She got off the bed and stood facing the door. He watched her shoulders rise and fall with each breath. Do you want to talk about it? He asked. She wheeled on him. Why would I tell you shit? You'll just leave anyways, once you're done with me and we're done with this. She gestured to the bathroom and the vault beyond. Won't you? That doesn't sound like a question, Evan said. It sounds like a dare. Don't turn it around on me, she said. It's the only outcome. There's never only one outcome. Yeah? How do you see it working? You're gonna what? Drive me to school? Bake muffins for the PTA? Help me with my fucking calculus? I think you'd probably help me with my calculus. She didn't smile. Barely even paused. You're just using me, like everyone else. You don't get it. Why would you? You chose to leave the program. You don't know what it's like to just be discarded. They threw me away because I was... Her lips pursed as she searched out the word. Deficient. You're not deficient. Yeah, I am. I'm broken. Then let's unbreak you. Oh, it's that easy. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm saying it's worth doing. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. Easy for you to say. She wiped her nose, pigging it up. She looked so young. Suffering is optional. Yes. Let me know when you're ready to start giving it up. I'll fucking do that. She walked out. He listened to her feet tap up the brief hall and across the great room, the noise echoing off all those hard surfaces. Then her steps quickened up the spiral stairs to the loft. Evan exhaled, rubbed his eyes. When he was younger, Jack had always known what to do, when to answer, when to leave a silence for Evan to fill. Right now, Evan felt adrift. He reached for the commandments, but none were applicable. He'd gone down the path and arrived at a wall. Another Jackism. When you're at a wall, start climbing. There he was, still pushing Evan from beyond the grave. Maybe that's what this final mission was, placing Joey in his care, a living, breathing package. Maybe this was just another version of Evan walking behind Jack, filling his footsteps. But this was a different trail. It required different rules. Evan thought of the post-it note Mia had put up in her kitchen. Remember that what you do not yet know is more important than what you already know. He tried to meditate again. Couldn't. Then he was up on his feet, moving silently along the hall, keying off the alarm and slipping out the front door, riding the elevator down, still pinching his eyes, shaking his head, walking up to 12B, raising a fist to knock, lowering it, walking away, coming back. He tapped gently. There. Now it was too late. The door opened. Mia looked at him.
I know you're angry with me, he said.
You told me you didn't have any family, she said. Either you lied before, or you're lying now.
It's complicated.
Save it for Facebook.
She started to close the door.
Wait, he said.
Joey is from my job. I'm trying to help her. And I wanted to keep you and Peter clear of anything that's related to that world. So I tried to cover it up. I was dumb enough to think I was being helpful.
That's even more alarming. He held his arms at his sides, considered his blink ratio, resisted an urge to put his hands in his pockets.
I'm not sure what you would have preferred me to do. At Target.
God, she said, more in wonderment than anger. You really don't get it.
No.
How about, hey, Mia, I'm in an unusual situation, and I'm not sure how to talk about it with you. How about that? Actually, just being honest and trusting that we'll figure it out. Was that an option you considered?
He said, no.
She almost laughed, her hand covering her mouth. When she took her hand away, the smile was gone.
Okay. I'm angry. But I've also learned not to trust my first reaction to anything.
So, let me figure out my second reaction before we talk about this anymore.
She started to close the door again.
I need advice, he said. The words rushed.
It had taken a lot to get them out.
Advice? She said. You're asking me. Advice?
Yes.
She pulled her head back on her neck, blew out her breath, let the door swing open.
Evan entered, and they sat on her couch.
She didn't offer him wine.
The door to Peter's bedroom, bedecked with Batman stickers, a pirate-themed Keep Out sign, and a Steph Curry poster, was open a crack. The heat was running. The condo toasty, a few candles casting gentle light. They were grapefruit-scented. No, blood orange. A burnt red chenille throw draped one arm of the couch. So many things he would never have thought of. The things that turn a house into a home. They were words from a different language. The language of comfort. Of knowing how to belong.
Evan kept his voice low. How do you talk to a teenage girl?
Very carefully, Mia said.
That much I've figured out.
She seems like a great kid, but she's had it tough.
How do you know that?
I'm a DA.
Mia set her hands on her thighs, tilted her head to the ceiling, took a breath.
Don't push. Just be there. Be steady.
He thought of Jack's even pace through the woods, not too fast, not too slow, his boots stamping the mud, showing Evan where to step.
Mia pointed at Evan. When it comes to kids, honesty matters, and consistency. That's why I thought, you know, you coming for dinner once a week. It's important to Peter. Stuff like that's a clock they set their hearts to.
He nodded.
At the end of the day, all they really want to hear?
Mia ticked the points off on her fingers.
You're okay. You're gonna be fine. You're worth it.
He nodded again.
She studied him.
What?
Are they worth it?
Yes.
She rose to see him out. But if you're ever gonna say it, you better believe it first.
She shot him a loaded look.
Because she'll know if you're lying.
Evan paused halfway up the spiral stairs to the loft. A clacking sound carried down to him, and it took a moment for him to place it. Joey working a Rubik's Cube. Lifted halfway between floor and ceiling, he had a glorious view of downtown. The shimmering blocks, a confusion of lights shivering in the night air. Overhead, The cube clacked and clacked. He heard Joey cough. It felt so odd to have another moving body in the penthouse. He continued up to the reading loft. Joey sat in a nest of sheets on the plush couch. Her head stayed down, that rich chocolate hair framing her face, which was furrowed with concentration. The cube, smaller than the previous one he'd seen, was a neon blur in her hands. She'd turned off the overheads and pulled the floor lamp close. It was on the lowest setting, casting her in a dim light. The cube alone was bright, glow-in-the-dark colors radiating in the semi-dark. Chewing gum green and fluorescent yellow, safety cone orange, and recycling can blue. At the second to top step, he halted. "Can I come in?" he asked. "It's your place." "But it's not my room." Her deft fingers flicked at the cube, transforming it by the second. "Yeah, it is." He noticed that she wasn't trying to solve the cube. She was alternating patterns on it, the colors morphing from stripes into checkers and back to stripes. He said, "Not right now." Her eyes ticked up, but her hands still flew, the cube obeying her will. It changed into four walls of solid color, and she let it dribble from her hands into her lap. "Yeah," she said, "you can come in." He stepped up into the loft and sat on the floor across from her, his back to one of the bookshelves. By her knee was the worn shoebox from her rucksack. The lid was off, and one of the greeting cards pulled out. She'd been reading it. He remembered what Mia had told him, and said nothing. Joey picked up the cube, put it down again. "It's such a big world," she said. "And I don't want it to just be this." "What?" "My life. My whole life. Kept here, kept there, always hiding. There's so much out there. So much I'm missing out on." Evan thought of the burnt red chenille throw draping the arm of Mia's couch. "Yeah," he said. "There is." Joey put the card into its envelope, slipped it into her shoebox, and set the lid back in place. "Sorry, I'm such an asshole sometimes," she said. "My man used to say, tiene dos trabajos, enojarse y contentarse." "It doesn't really translate right." Evan said, "You have two jobs, getting angry and getting not angry again." "Something like that, yeah." He said, "You were close to her." Joey finally looked up and met his stare.
"She was everything."
It was, Evan realized, the longest they had ever held eye contact. Joey finally slid off the couch.
"I have to brush my teeth," she said.
She lifted the shoebox from the sheets. As she passed, she let it drop to the floor beside him. A show of trust. She entered the bathroom, closed the door. He heard water running. He waited a moment and then lifted the lid. A row of greeting cards filled the shoebox from end to end. He ran his thumb across the tops of the cards. The front two-thirds had been opened. The rear third had not. And then he understood. He felt his chest swell, slight pressure beneath his cheeks, emotion coming to roost in his body. He used his knuckles to push back the stack so he could lift out the first card. Flocked gold lettering read, "It's your 9th birthday, a most happy day, a time to sing and a time to play." He opened the card, ignoring the rest of the printed greeting. An iris was pressed inside, already gone to pieces. Familiar feminine handwriting filled the blank page. "My sweet, sweet girl. The first one without me will be the hardest.
I'm sorry I'm not there with you. I'm sorry I got sick. I'm sorry I wasn't strong enough to beat it. Let my love for you be like a sun that warms you from above. Forever and always. M.
Evan put the card back. He flicked through the ones behind it. New Year's, Valentine's, Easter, birthday, first day of school, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas. He took a wet breath, let the next set of cards tick past his thumb. New Year's, Valentine's, Easter, birthday, first day of school, Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas. The last opened card was Thanksgiving, the one that had fallen out of her rucksack in the footwell of the stolen car yesterday. He pulled out the one behind it, sealed in an envelope that said, Christmas. He scrolled ahead, the labels jumping out at him. Easter. Halloween. Your 18th birthday. And then they stopped. In the bathroom, the sink water turned off. He closed the shoebox, set it back on the couch, and returned to where he'd been sitting. Joey emerged, wiping her face on a towel. She slung it over the couch back and sat again on the cushions and sheets. She noted the shoebox's return, and then stared at her lap. Finally, she said, "That's when I went into the system. I'm sorry. The cards.
They're gonna run out when I turn 18, Joey said. Then what'll I have?"
He showed her the respect of not offering an answer.
"After I ran away from Vanskyver, that's where Jack found me. Visiting her grave."
She looked down, gave a soft smile. Her thick mane was swept across, the shaved side exposed. Two halves of beautiful whole.
"He was smart like that. He knew how my heart worked."
Evan nodded, not trusting his voice.
"Yes, he was.
Yes, he did." After a time, Joey slid down into the sheets and curled up, her head on the pillow.
"I never fall asleep with anyone in the room," she said.
"Should I leave?"
"If you want to stay, it's fine,"
Evan said.
"I do."
He sat and watched the curve of her shoulder, the tousled hair on her cheek. Her blinks grew languorous, and then her eyes closed. Her breathing grew regular, took on a rasp. He rose silently and eased from the room. 48. Something Akin to Pride. After checking the deep learning software in the vault before sunrise the next morning, Evan meditated, showered, and then walked down the hall to the kitchen. Joey was up early as well, digging in the freezer, an ice pack in one hand, the bottle of Stoli Elite, Himalayan edition, in the other. She heard him coming and looked over her shoulder. "Don't you have any frozen burritos or whatever?" "Careful with that," Evan said, nodding at the Stoli. "It's $3,000 a bottle." Joey appraised it. "Is it worth it?" "No vodka is worth $3,000.
"Then why do you have it?"
"What else am I going to spend it on?" She stared into the pristine white void of his freezer. "I don't know. Food?" He came around the island. "Out of my way," he said. Two eggs dropped in the frying pan with a this-is-your-brain-on-drugs sizzle. Joey sat on a stool, leaning over the island counter, chin resting on her laced fingers, fascinated. "You know how to cook?" she asked. "I'd hardly call this cooking."
"How do you learn?"
"Jack." "You fit it in between drown-proofing and close-quarters combat?"
"Yes."
Mr. Humor. The toaster dinged, and Evan flicked two pieces of sourdough onto a plate. Butter? Duh. He buttered the toast and slid the eggs atop the two slices. Go snap some parsley off the living wall. Living wall? The vertical garden. There. She walked over. Which one's the parsley? Upper left quadrant near the edge. No. No. Yes. She tore off a piece, brought it over as he twisted pepper from the mill onto the sunny side ups. He halved the sprig, laid a piece on each yolk. Then he set the plate before her, nudging it so it was precisely between knife and fork. She stared down at the plate, not moving. What? He said. Just appreciating it, she said. Eat. She looked up at him, cleared her throat. Thank you. Before he could reply, a chime sounded over the wireless speaker system. His head snapped up. What's that? She asked. He was already heading back. Software just hit on David Smith. They stood side by side within the damp concrete walls of the vault, staring at the monitors. The interconnected web of metadata on display was fascinating. From the scant information on David Smith and a few photos, the software had made height and weight projections, assessed facial structure changes, checked hospital intakes, flight and bus records, school registrations, and foster home placements in targeted regions on the East Coast. These criteria correlating space, time, visuals, database entries, and events had been dynamically created so the machine would heuristically improve itself, learning as it went, ever-evolving. Strange algorithms tracked online purchase orders, grouping vehicular-themed Star Wars Lego sets costing $9.95 or less, industrial-strength drain cleaner, bulk-ordered Little Hug fruit barrel drinks, Lavex janitorial brown paper towel rolls, and dozens more items, narrowing the scope even further. These results were paired with Instagram photos and other social media posts clustered around specific neighborhoods. A YouTube video of a schoolyard fight at Hopewell High in Richmond, Virginia, posted in September of the previous year, had caught a wink of a passing car in the background. Despite the midday glare off the passenger window, a freeze frame had captured the ear of the boy in the passenger seat, which had been picked apart using precise distances and ratios, measuring the upper margin of the ear canal's opening to the tip of the lower lobe and the flap of the tragus. It gave an 85% probability that the ear belonged to their David Smith. 2 days previous, a girl had been adopted out of McClare Children's Mental Health Center in Richmond's Church Hill neighborhood, opening a spot in what had previously been a steady 40-bed population. No new child showed to have been committed at the center since, the population seemingly remaining at 39. However, a bill from a local health clinic the following week showed a new patient intake exam, and the number of flu shots administered the next month remained a steady 40. A child, taken into the center under a false claim of domestic violence, would have been kept off the books. The deep learning software gave a 99.9743% likelihood that the mystery patient was the boy previously known as David Smith. Joey jotted down the address, biting her lower lip, frowning with concentration. The light of the monitors played off her smooth cheeks. Evan watched her, feeling something akin to pride. She caught him looking. What? He said, nothing. All you could hear was the man's panting. Blood flecked the floor, the plywood over the windows, the mattresses on the walls. A molar rested on the plastic tarp. The room stank of vomit, body odor, and worse. Two of the three Arrowhead water cooler jugs were empty. That was 10 gallons of fluid forced through Orphanelle's face holes. Draker lay on the floor, curled up in a ball. His head was duct-taped, a slit left open for the nostrils. Van Sciver squatted, waiting. Thornhill was balanced on his hands again, doing inverted push-ups. The guy was the friggin' Energizer Bunny. Candy had left to organize the freelancers Van Sciver had called up from Alabama. Things were about to get busy. Van Sciver finally rose with a groan. He was feeling it in his back. Thornhill, he said. Thornhill's boots hit the ground with a thump. He started unwinding the duct tape from Al's head. As he did, a faint tinny music became audible, growing louder with each loop of tape unstripped. At last he got to the final layer, which he tore free, ripping out clumps of Al's hair and splotching his flesh with broken capillaries. The Beats headphones adhered to Draker's head were now laid bare, Josh Groban blaring "You Raise Me Up" at top volume. Thornhill turned off the music, tugged off the headphones. He stroked Draker's hair, pushing the sweat-pasted bangs out of his eyes. "You did good," Thornhill said. "Better than Jack could have asked. But this will continue forever." Draker managed a single hoarse syllable. "No. You know it's gotta go this way," Van Sciver said. "It is what it is, and that's all that it is." Draker squeezed his eyes shut and panted some more. He'd developed a tic at the top of his left cheek, the skin spasming, tugging the eyelid into a droop. "Okay," Van Sciver said. "Get him back on the bench." Thornhill started for the arrowhead jug. Draker began to sob. Van Sciver held up a hand, freezing Thornhill. "This was the glorious moment right before they broke." He let Draker weep. The sound was gut-wrenching, dredged up from the depths. Thornhill petted his hair. "It's okay," he said. "You did good. You did so good." Draker keened and keened. Finally, he quieted. Van Sciver waited for his breathing to slow. After all El had been through, he deserved a few moments of rest before the end. Draker looked up through bloodshot eyes. "I'll tell you," he said. "I'll tell you where he is." 49. Good isn't enough. "You missed him by an hour, Mr. Man," the charge nurse said. A broad woman packed into navy blue polyester pants and a billowing white nurse coat, she conveyed warmth and authority in equal measure. A sunshine logo on her coat accompanied equally cheery canary yellow lettering, which read, "McClare Children's Mental Health Center." Evan put away his forged Child Protective Services credential, flapping closed the worn brown billfold. The wallet, in addition to his frayed Dockers and Timex watch, were props that screamed "ordinary guy" on state employee salary. Tapping his clipboard against his thigh, he hurried to accompany the nurse as she ambled down the hall. "Missed him," Evan said. "What do you mean, missed him? His caseworker visitation is overdue." "Baby doll, the only things here that ain't overdue are the late notices on the bills. We are bailing out a rowboat with a Dixie cup." In one of the rooms, a kid was thrashing against the wall and bellowing. Two orderlies restrained him, one for each arm. The nurse stopped in the doorway. "Come on now, Daryl," she said. "Act like you got some sense in you." The boy calmed, and she kept on. A few perfunctory posters were gummed to the bare walls, tattered and ripped. Lichtenstein apple, Picasso face, a faded starry night. Stacked on a service cart were dining trays filled with half-eaten meals. Watery green beans, cube of cornbread, hard-crusted grilled cheese sandwiches. The place smelled of industrial detergent, bleach, and kids of a certain age kept in close proximity.
Evan knew this place. Knew it in his bones. He cleared his throat as if nervously, adjusted his fake glasses.
You said I missed Jesse Watson?
Joey's additional online machinations had confirmed that this was the name David Smith had been living under at the Richmond facility. Joey was outside now in the rented minivan, a block away in an overwatch position near the intersection. The nurse paused and heaved a sigh that smelled of peppermint.
He ran away.
Ran away? When?
Like I said, he was gone before 7 o'clock bed check. So call it an hour, maybe an hour and a half.
Must have slipped out the back door during the commotion. Her mouth tweaked left, a show of sympathy. Girl in six had a grand mal at mealtime. Evan shoved his glasses up his nose, a cover for the actual dread he felt rising from his stomach into his throat. She registered his concern.
We already filed the police report.
I'm sorry, but it's in their hands now. Okay. I'll just do a living conditions check and be on my way. We do the best we can do here with the state funds shrinking all the time. I understand.
Do you?
I do. She stopped and took his measure, the raised freckles bunching high on her copper-colored cheeks. Then she blew out a breath, deflating.
Look at us, acting like we on different sides. I'm sorry, Mr.
Wayne.
Mr. Wayne, I know you're just trying to do the best you can, too. I guess it's...
Her not-insignificant bosom heaved.
I guess I'm embarrassed. We can't do better by them. I use my own salary for Christmas and birthday gifts. The director, too. He's a good man. But good isn't enough sometimes.
No, Evan said. Sometimes it's not.
Which room was he in?
14, she said. We group the kids with less severe conditions in the C hall. We're talking ADHD, dyslexia, visual motor stuff.
And Jesse's condition was...
Evan flipped through the pages.
Conduct disorder.
Of course. She waved a hand adorned with hammered metal rings.
Come on, I'll walk you.
The walk took longer than Evan would have liked, but he held her pace. They passed a girl, sitting on the floor picking at the hem of her shirt. Her fingernails were bitten to the quick, leaving spots of blood on the fabric.
"Hi, baby doll. Be back for you in a second, okay?" the nurse said.
The girl turned vacant eyes up toward them as they passed. She had beautiful, thick hair like Joey's, a similarity Evan chose not to linger on. The nurse finally arrived at room 14, knocked on the door once briskly, and opened it. The three boys inside, all around the age of 13 like David Smith, lounged on bunk beds, tapping on cheap phones. In another time, in another place, Evan had lived in this room.
"This is Mr. Wayne," the nurse said.
The oldest-looking kid shot a quick glance at Evan and said,
"Lucky as us. Another social worker.
Respect, Jor-El, or I'll notch you down to red on the board again." Evan asked, "Did any of you see Jesse Watson run away?" They all shook their heads.
"He didn't talk about it before.
No planning, nothing?"
"Nah," Jor-El said. "That fool was bent. For a skinny white boy, he was nails. Could fight like a mofo. He had things his own way."
"Jor-El," the nurse said wearily. It wasn't the first time she'd said his name like that. Or the 100th.
"Where were you guys before bed check?" Evan said.
"Still in the calf," another kid said. "Minding our business. Jesse come back to the room early. Do push-ups and shit. He say he gonna be a Marine."
Evan stepped inside, pointed.
"This his bunk?"
"The very one," Jor-El said.
Jor-El was a smart kid.
Smart kids in places like this tended to have worse outcomes. A nice, dumb boy could toe the line, graduate with C's, get a steady job at a fast food joint, live to see 30. On the radiator by the empty lower left bunk rested a Lego version of a Star Wars rebel commanding a snowspeeder. Evan recognized it from one of Peter's comic books. He picked it up. This was Jesse's?
Yeah, ain't that some white boy shit?
All three kids laughed, even the Caucasian one. The charge nurse said, "You just dying for me to level you down tonight, ain't that so, Jor-El?" He silenced. Holding the snowspeeder, Evan stepped back to her, said quietly, "I'm guessing this was one of the gifts that came out of your salary." She nodded. Evan said, "It's probably the only thing in the world he has that's actually his." Her mocha eyes held the weight of all 40 lives she'd been charged with. "That's probably right. I doubt he'd run away and leave it behind."
"What are you saying, Mr. Wayne?
The boy broke out. Happens all the time."
Evan set the Lego Rebel back on the radiator and stepped toward the sash window. It rattled up arthritically. He leaned out, noted the fresh gouge marks in the paint on the sill. "They usually break out from the outside," he said. The charge nurse came over and looked at the window, and her hand pressed against her neck. Seeing her expression, he regretted his phrasing.
"I'll call the police again," she said quietly.
The boys had silenced. Even Jor-El had sobered up. Evan started for the door. "Like you said, it's in their hands now." As he hustled out, he passed that girl in the hall, forgotten, picking at the hem of her shirt with bloody fingernails. In his mind's eye, he pictured Joey sitting in her place. He blinked away the image, banishing it from his thoughts, and kept on. 50. The Best Hat Trick. Evan sat in the passenger seat of the minivan, the Virginia sun pounding the windshield. Joey had taken the news of David Smith's kidnapping stoically, though he'd noticed her fists whiten on the steering wheel as he'd filled her in. "1 hour," she finally said. "1 hour earlier, and we could have saved him."
"We don't know that he's dead," Evan said.
"Orphan J, Orphan C, Orphan L, all the other names on that file are dead. Except me. If Van Sciver kidnapped David Smith, he already killed him." They stared up the block at the crumbling facade of the McClare Children's Mental Health Center. It radiated a kind of despair that resonated in Evan's cells. He thought of the boys he'd grown up with in Pride House, Andre and Danny and Tyrell and Ramon. Every so often, Evan checked in on them from the safe remove of the vault, searching them out in the databases. Danny was serving a dime for armed robbery at the Chesapeake Detention Facility, his third stint. Ramon had overdosed in a by-the-hour motel in Cherry Hill. Tyrell had finally managed to join the army, KIA outside Mosul, on his first deployment. Any one of their fates should have been shared by Evan. He was them, and they were him. Until Jack. Searching for hope here on this block was hard. But Evan tried. David Smith was owed that much. If Van Sciver wanted him dead, why didn't they just shoot him in the room? Evan said.
Because that would be a big public thing, Joey said. A runaway's just another story.
When a kid gets killed in a neighborhood like this, it's not a big public thing. It's two lines of print below the fold. Everyone would think it was gang retribution. Remember, no one in the world knows who David Smith is.
Except Van Sciver, Joey said. And us.
Evan felt it then. The first ray of hope. Straw thin and pale, not enough to warm him, but enough to lead the way. The smart move isn't to kill him. The smart move is to use him for bait.
So what do we do?
Joey asked. Swallow the hook.
let them reel.
And if he's already dead? Evan stared at the sign above the security gate of the facility's front door. A number of the letters were smashed or broken. He said, "It's a chance I have to take." That sounds less than strategic. The 10th commandment. "Never let an innocent die," she quoted. "So where do we start?" Evan took out the Samsung Galaxy cell phone he'd lifted off the dead man in Portland. He called up Signal, the encrypted comms software that led directly to Van Sciver. He was about to press the icon to call when he realized that his emotions around this place and these foster kids were infecting him, making him reckless. He thumbed the phone back off. "We need to gather more intel before I make contact," he said. "There's an ATM at the gas station 2 blocks that way, facing the street. Maybe we can get the security footage, see what we see." Joey made a sound in her throat, unimpressed. "What?" "If they drove that route," she said. "If we know who we're looking for." She was leaning forward, straining the seatbelt, seemingly peering up at the telephone wires overhead. "You have a better suggestion?" Evan asked. "As a matter of fact, I do." She pointed through the windshield. "See those streetlights?"
"Yes."
"They're not just streetlights." She reached into the back seat, retrieving her laptop. "Those are sensitive systems lights. We're talking thermal, sound, shock, video. They continuously gather information and suck everything into the cloud." She ran her fingers through her hair, flipped it over so the shaved strip showed above her right ear. "Remember how Van Sciver got onto Orphanelle?" A surveillance photo of him smoking. "Taken from a streetlight," she said. "We're going to use Van Sciver's game against him." Evan stared at the streetlights, but they looked ordinary to him. "You sure those are the kind you're talking about?" She gave him a look, then booted up her computer. He said, "How can they afford something like that in a broke neighborhood like this?" Her fingers were already working the keys in a fury. "Federal funding. It's part of the Safe Cities Initiative. Detroit got $100 million off the government, and if Detroit can get it..." She glanced over. "You don't keep up on this stuff, do you?"
"No."
"The streetlights are all LED. The whole system gets paid for by the money cities save from the reduction in electricity costs. How about that? A government plan that isn't a total cluster. Not that it started with the government. The software was developed to track foot traffic at shopping malls, see what stores people go into, what they look at, how they respond to sales announcements, coupons, all that."
"Can you hack it?"
She kept her head lowered, her fingers moving. "I'm going to pretend you didn't ask me that." He cast an eye toward the facility's front door. "The cops are going to be here soon."
"Well," she said, "then it's a good thing I'm fast."
"Turn left up there. No, the next intersection."
"Good.
Now run it straight for a half mile." Evan was driving the minivan, Joey in the passenger seat, directing him through traffic and simultaneously hammering away at the laptop. He felt increasingly like her chauffeur, an observation that, he was chagrined to note, Mia had once made in regard to Peter. Evan was becoming just another suburban dad. Joey had what looked like a dozen windows open on the screen. He risked a glance over. On one of them, she seemed to be reviewing footage angled on the eastern flank of the McClare Children's Mental Health Center. "Anything?" he asked.
"Patience, young Padawan."
The laptop was humming.
"Wait, you were supposed to turn left back there. Hang on."
She popped another window to the fore, this one featuring a GPS map. "Go left, left, right." He obeyed, focusing on the road and the rearview mirrors rather than on Joey's active laptop screen, took some discipline.
"Okay, just pull over here. We're in range."
He looked around. A fenced park, a courthouse, a McDonald's. "In range of what?" he said. She ignored the question.
"Let's get you up to speed."
She punched a button, swiveled the laptop on the minivan's roomy center console. Evan watched the exterior of Sea Hall, the image so steady that, save for a few leaves blowing past and the sound of out-of-frame traffic, it might have been a photograph. At last, a pair of shadows darkened the bottom of the screen. 2 men approached the window of room 14. One held a crowbar, the other a pistol lengthened by a suppressor. The guy holding the pistol moved aggressively, sweat glistening on his